And so in the background is a picture of a core sample taken from some saprolite, and this is at Oak Ridge, in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And it's kind of a great core to look at in terms of examining how heterogeneity, physical heterogeneity, might impact contaminant transport. So here's kind of another wall of it right here, and you can see that there's all this interbedded, it's a shale and limestone, it forms large preferential flow pathways. And between those, you can see there's tightly packed, kind of a tightly packed pore matrix. And so we can imagine that, there's a high degree of mass transfer that can occur between these preferential flow pathways and these kind of more smaller pathways that are defined more by, or where mass transfer is defined more by diffusion. And so if we go even around the world, this is taken from Cambodia. It's a picture of some clay sediments that were variably oxidized. And so even there we can see that there's a lot of preferential flow, and we have zones of oxic, that are oxic, where we can have iron oxides, and in between that we can have kind of more packed zones that have very tight pore structure, where conditions can go anaerobic, and subsequently you get a lot of reduced iron minerals and a lot of gray kind of glade minerals. And so heterogeneity is very common, and again we can imagine there's just a wide distribution of pore networks in soils and sediments, some ranging from less than 10 microns, again, where diffusion controls mass transfer, to large preferential flow pathways that can be greater than 500 microns. And so we can look at some mathematical relationships that describe solute transfer through these kind of systems. And I'll just draw your attention to this equation down at the bottom right here. This is just an expression that describes mass transfer between mobile and immobile domains, multiplied by the first order kind of rate constant. And all it's saying is that there's mass transfer occurring between small and large pore domains. And so these kind of expressions are often used to describe solutes, but often we don't know what's actually happening in a system, and we don't really have a good handle on actually seeing into the aggregate structure. And so this is a X-ray fluorescence map, and all it does is it shows that there's a large degree of heterogeneity, not only in the physical structure of this little PED right here, but also in the distribution of iron. And so we see that there's a large distribution or large variation in the amount of iron that's existing along these bedding planes in this piece of shale. And so with all this natural complexity, the question becomes, how can we start to unravel some of these processes that are going on, where you have complex physical structure that are interrelated with complex biogeochemistry. And so one of the ways we can do that is by just constructing flow cells to actually look at flow and biogeochemistry. And so in this case, what we have on the left side is just a field of sand, and this is about 6 centimeters by 2 centimeters. And on this side, there's a small field of sand overlying some gibbsite. And I think this was an animation, but it's the animation's not going to work quite right. But this is the end frame, and basically, if we just run a visual tracer through, we can start to be able to visualize what's happening in these kind of physically complex systems with disparate pore structures. And so we can use these systems to visualize flow, and we can also use them to visualize what's happening with contaminants. And one way we can do that is by packing flow cells like this with materials that we're interested in that we'd want to look at below ground or that would represent ideal materials to examine the fate of contaminants. So in this case, we can imagine packing one of these flow cells with ferry hydride-coated sand, just as a model oxide, and putting a small low permeability zone in here that's inoculated with Schuonella putrefaciens, which is an iron-reducing bacteria. And this could represent like a small, tightly packed pore domain Again, where diffusion controls mass transfer rather than invection in the sand field. And we can make this low permeability zone. In this case, what we did is we made it out of sand infused with agarose. And so, we can have an artificial groundwater solution coming through on the left side here, advecting up around this zone and out through this effluent. And then what we could do is we could take this whole setup to the synchrotron and actually examine, either in real time or kind of on a destructive basis, what's happening in the cell, and in this case, what the fate of chromium is. And so, again, what we have in this cell is an artificial groundwater solution running down through up and through the left side, and it's advecting up through the cell and out on the right side. And we have that small zone here that's actually right there. You can see it. That's a low permeability. And so chromium is making its way in. These are X-ray fluorescence maps, making its way into the cell and advecting up through. And we see it eventually get into this low permeability zone. And then indeed, we can perform microspectroscopy on this zone. This one turned out a little bit dark, but that low permeability zone is really it's very darkened compared to the rest of the field. And what's happened is iron-reducing bacteria have reduced iron to iron 2. The iron 2 has then reduced our chromate solution that's been running through, and we're getting the formation of a mixed chromium 3 hydroxide in this low permeability zone. And so we can use these kind of cells to actually visualize what's happening with a contaminant complex physical and biogeochemical system. And so in this case, what we can do is do the same thing with uranium. And we chose a slightly different reactor setup to do this. In this case, instead of there being just one small low permeability zone, we decided to have one flow channel running up through the length of our column that's filled with sand, ferrohydrite-coated sand. And then on the other sides, it's gibbsite coated with ferrohydrite. And so now we have two zones, one where, here mass transfer is dominated by a diffusion, and we're getting advection up through the center. And you can see through a time series of just looking at dye injected into that advective zone that eventually the dye diffuses out into the matrix. Okay, and so I'll take a step back here really quick and just kind of go over a simple conceptual diagram on the chemistry of uranium. That'll be relevant to the slides I'll show you in a moment. If we start with the uranyl ion, there's a few important reactions that will influence the fate of uranium, amongst many, but these are some of the big ones. Uranyl form strong complexes with carbonate, and this will actually make uranium more soluble because the uranyl ion will precipitate out, hundreds of micromolars of concentration. And so you can get these very strong complexes that increase the solubility of uranium. If we go over on the left, right side here, if we have calcium in a system, which we often do, we can get the formation of uranyl calcium carbonate complexes. And it turns out that organisms can't reduce uranyl that is bound to calcium, nor can abiotic reduction of uranyl take place, such as by iron 2. And so, whereas if you have just uranyl or uranyl carbonate, you can get microbial or indirect reduction and get solid phase uraninite precipitating. Whereas with this calcium carbonate carbonate complex, you cannot. You can also get sorbed uranium, of course, to oxide surfaces. And then something I won't talk about today, which other people in our lab have looked at, is you can get the reduction and oxidation of uranium by the iron oxyhydroxides themselves. Okay, and so what we want to do then is take our system and begin to examine what the fate of uranium would be if we pre-sorbed it into these systems. And so for treatments, what we have are ferrohydrite coated onto the gibbsite and the within the advective flow domain onto the sand. And then, again, I won't talk about this today, but we have some other treatments, which are aluminum or silicon coated or substituted for hydrides as well. And that changes the iron chemistry substantially. But for today, I'm just going to talk about ferrihydrite. And then we have some of these running now. We inoculate these to begin with Schoenel putrefactions, again, to induce iron-reducing conditions and to examine the fate of uranium when you know there's iron reduction and uranium reduction occurring. And we're using about 80 ppm uranium sorbed to these the iron oxides in these cells as well. Okay, and then what we can do is we can take our outflow data and we can try running some reactive transport models to see if we can describe what's happening accurately in our system or at least try to capture some of the major processes that are happening in our system. And so today what I'm going to show you is basically just desorption data. And so without showing you some of the cells that are still running that have the organisms that are reducing iron, I'll show you some of the desorption data we're getting as we run influent through these systems and as uranium desorbs and it moves out of the system. And then I'll show you some of the reactive transport models that we've run as well to kind of show give you an idea of what a couple of scenarios would look like when we actually get some biogeochemistry going. Okay, so first of all, this is on the y-axis is just aqueous uranium. This is in the effluent. And this is time in days. And this is our data. And it looks a little bit scattered, but I'll say these are nanomolar concentrations. So we're getting way down there. So it's tough to get good data at that level. But we're getting it. And if we apply surface complexation constants that we find, you know, for example, in from Waite and Davis and others, we actually get really good fits to our data in terms of defining a reactive surface complexation model or a surface complexation model and a reactive transport model that describes our what kind of iron oxide we have and how many sites we have and everything. And so within our, these 2D plots are basically aqueous and sorbed uranium. And we expect, of course, as our clean effluent comes in, picks up uranium and then is, you know, effluxed out. And that sorbed uranium stays fairly constant. But then we can look at a couple other scenarios. What if we have our Schumannella going, which we do, I just don't have the data up yet for it. What if we actually get uranium and iron reduction transpiring in these systems? Of course, one of the things that can happen is you can get uraninite forming after organisms start reducing the uranium. And of course, that's going to drop the uranium precipitation, and aqueous concentrations will become quite low. And so, if we let that transpire, we can look right here, and in the model, you know, we predict high amounts of uraninite dropping out of solutions, or out of the solution, and in our model, we're just going to show that uranium is going to drop out. But what's interesting is if we add calcium into the system, and again, calcium inhibits the reduction of this uranyl complex, then we don't get uraninite dropping out of solution. Instead, we see, we predict at least, that there's a large amount of uranyl that's going to start, or aqueous uranium that's going to start coming out of our system. And the reason that happens is, if we kind of overlay these images again of what we would see in our reactor, what we're getting is a lot of iron reduction and a lot of carbonate that's building up in these diffusively controlled domains. And with that high carbonate concentration, it's going to draw a lot of uranium into solution. You can see that down here. And that's going to start effluxing the system. And you can see that down here, too, in the models at least, where in our base case, where we only have iron reduction transpiring with no calcium, there's a lot of sorbed uranium. And when you put calcium in, the sorbed uranium concentrations really decrease. Okay, so the last thing I'll just mention briefly is that's not the only, the aqueous side of things is what I showed you, and kind of the surface complexation is what I showed you, but there's also solid phase iron transformations that can transpire. So ferrihydrite can transform into goethite, into other secondary minerals when iron 2 is around. And so other people in our lab, and me a little bit, are looking at how uranium is following and partitioning in with those minerals as the ferrihydrite starts to transform. That's another thing we're kind of adding into our whole experimental matrix. Okay, so in summary, we're trying to come up with systems where we can simulate basically what's happening in a natural kind of advective versus diffusively controlled system. And these reactors are really good for looking at redox zonation and mapping out that zonation using more novel techniques like the synchrotron XRF mapping. And that's pretty much it. Go through some acknowledgments really quick. I didn't put one person on here. There's a guy named Parker Weiss who's been taking care of my experiments all the time. I just wanted to mention him. But that's pretty much it.